Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and I have a very important guest today, and I think it's a story that Canadians and people around the world want to remember, that in March 1979, there was a wonderful development in Grenada. The New Jewel movement overthrew the government of Eric Gehry, who is uniformly, I think, agreed, was a despot. And they brought in all kinds of new programs, and it was certainly an exciting time, but it is not remembered as it should be, because it was later in October 1983, Ronald Reagan chose to intervene there with the U.S. Marine Corps and to criminalize the political leadership of the New Jewel. It's a very important story. And central to it is a woman, Phyllis Cord, wife of Bernard Cord, who was the deputy prime minister. But Phyllis Cord was a leader in her own right. Phyllis has died only recently, September the 8th. And we're going to be speaking to John Callist, who knew Phyllis Cord and interacted with these leaders. John, welcome to the program.
Yes, welcome. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I know you've been talking yourself about Phyllis Cord and her loss. She wrote a book. Thank heaven we have the book.
Right.
Called Unchained. It's just recently released.
Right.
A very important story. So tell us, what have you been telling your listeners and friends about Phyllis Cord?
Well, talking about Phyllis Cord, I've been saying to my listeners and my friends who have not had the opportunity to associate with her on a personal level, that she's a wonderful woman, a good mother, a good wife, a woman's right activist, a woman who took women's issues very serious, who had contributed to the women development in Grenada from 1978, that far back I could remember, reading information on Phyllis. I had the opportunity to serve in a personal security level with Bernard, her husband, as the personal security for almost three and a half years of the time they've been in office. So I live in their house, basically. So I've seen and see the operations from both angles. Committed woman to her work and to the struggle, you know, not only in Grenada, but in the region and in Africa and everybody said that. So to me, she was the stalwart, a real activist, a real woman that had concern for women the world over, and particularly in Grenada, knowing that what the women in Grenada went through. A matter of fact, Phyllis was the one instrumental in getting the women's rights movement going, the women organization going, the equal pay for equal work. That was her, also really part of her work, her fingerprints, if for lack of a better word, append that, you know, making sure that women right, equal people, equal work, maternity leave, you know. She never really get the full credit for that, but I mean, people in her circles will tell you she was the one who really, when Maurice Bishop speaks of it, is really from the organization that Phyllis, the women's organization, you know, while that was happening. So she was very instrumental in ensuring that women's rights was given to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was that experience? I mean, people forget just how what a change in the culture that the New Jewel represented. It was very much welcomed, I gather. What sort of work was she doing, and how did the women respond to the programs that she was initiating?
Well, I think all the programs headed by Phyllis was well received. I mean, women was if you look back at some of the videos, women would tell you that they felt empowered. They felt like, you know, I am in touch with reality here. I see a change happening in the country. I want to be part of it, you know. And because of the leadership role that she played in educating women and developing the leadership role of women in the different communities, you know, we hear women speak of police, you know, late nights with them, you know, to ensure that work get done for the next day, you know. So you go out and you see the work because you see people on the ground, people who want to be in the militia, they want to be in the women's organization, you know, and all of this stuff. People, women wasn't shying away. I mean, when you put a women's rally together, you have thousands of women coming out, you know. They want to be part of the movement. Women are joining up the movement, you know. And so that the event was proof that work was being done and was spearheaded by Phyllis.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We're speaking to Jean Caliste. By the way, you can find Jean on a program. It's the Genesis Magazine radio station.
That's Gem FM. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the online family station.
Yes.
What were the difficulties? What was the kinds of problems that they were having to do? When the New Jewel came on the scene, it was, you had neighboring countries. You had Trinidad, Tobago. You had Mr. Manley in Jamaica. You had, and people might have to remember, I think it was Forbes Burnham was in
Guyana.
And
Tom Adams in Barbados.
Yeah.
Eugenia Charles in Dominica.
How did they react? Relations like?
I think there was this discontent by those government towards Grenada. The hostility from Barbados and Dominica and Ciaga in Jamaica, you know, the negativity, you know, was really overpouring. But again, we was able to address them by the progress that we made in Grenada. The Center for Popular Education, the free milk, the free education, university education across the board, free health care for everybody, women's rights, you know, agro industries, the international airport, you know, all those stuff was.
You were kind of challenging their old promises, right? Many of those leaders had reputations at one time, but hadn't been able to deliver, right?
No. And understand the leadership of Grenada was pretty young, too, you know. And again, the evidence of youth involvement was ever present in the youth organization, the pioneer movement, you know, and the militia, you know, the women's organization, the, you know, and so on. So you see they have across the board a full spectrum of support. The student movement, which I was part of, again, the National Students Council, growing up. So all of those little pockets of organizations in Grenada had supported the erosion to the hilt. You know, what you find happening over that 4.5 year period, you always have the counter-revolutionary, which was actually a disruptive minority, you know what I mean? And was not, today, look at who they are today. Some of them are, some of the counter-revolutionaries are now in power and they cannot deliver, you know, the way they should be delivering to the people of Grenada, you know? You know, the proof is in the pudding and people still contrasting. Look at what the revolution has done in 4.5 years. What have you done in 25 years? Show me something that you have done in 25 years. You know, show me something that of significance. I mean, the biggest project the NAP government has taken on is the National Stadium. Yet, healthcare is still in a scramble. We have one of the worst healthcare in the Caribbean. You know, people are afraid to go to the hospital for fear that they die. You know, people are taking a chance and go to Trinidad. You know. So we have that we could say, hey, show me your hand. Show me what you have done. You know, and the young people in Grenada are still calling for the programs of the revolution. It's evident. Go everywhere. People heard about it. Young people heard about it. Say, well, why is this government not doing this today? You know, so it is something that is wanting. The programs of the revolution is still wanting in Grenada.
Yeah. So they, it is a good time to revisit the vision that the new Jewel offered, and also the fact that, as you say, there's been a stagnation where much was accomplished. Tragically, you had really powerful enemies. I guess in Ronald Reagan's presidency in the United States, he was ideologically a driven government. Mm. They always talk about ideology. Ronald Reagan embodied a very reactionary ideology.
Yes.
But also, Britain wasn't that helpful. And as you say, there's other states in the region that weren't. Mm. Of course, it was the invasion, and the precipitating cause was a political crisis of the new Jewel, and it's just large. People should understand it. As a result of that invasion, Phyllis Cord went to prison for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Bernard Cord, many, many years. And just to focus on her for a moment, she actually, I think it was Lord Gifford said, well, she actually wasn't in the political bureau, the leadership.
No, she wasn't. She
was a political personality, but not a one that you could say had executive authority.
No, she didn't.
And he said basically that she went to prison because she was the wife of the deputy prime minister, Bernard Cord.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your view?
This is my view. I mean, they understand the power of the woman in the movement, who they understood her work, what she did to create what was happening. The women's movement was a very powerful movement, and Phyllis Cord was the leader of that. You know, then you had a powerful husband who also the minister of finance, planning, and development in Grenada, who also one of the key leaders of the Maastrichtian revolution. So you have these two forces. Understand, when we look at the dynamics of the leadership of Grenada, the prime minister's wife wasn't really active. She left, you know. He had a girlfriend, was Jackie, the minister of education. She's Jackie, yes, and we respect her as minister, but she was not that influential in the women's movement as Phyllis Cord was. You know, see? So you understand, by saying this, you understand what's happening with the founding members, so-called founding members of the NJM, who never wanted to release themselves to allow growth, you know? So Phyllis become that stumbling block. So every eyes was on Phyllis. Yes, Phyllis helped us, Phyllis did this, Phyllis did that. So within the network of the revolution, Phyllis was the woman that lead, that championed the cause for women. It wasn't Jackie, it wasn't Maurice's wife, it was Phyllis Cord who did all of that. So when one look back and take and evaluate the organization itself, you see who really, really stirred up the crowd, stirred up the masses around the women's movement, right? Based on her leadership, you know, training and leading young women to take roles, you know, to take leadership roles and training them to go out there and mobilize and educate young women. So that was one of the biggest thing. The attack was against her for that.
You know, it's very interesting that culturally, we have a problem that a woman does outstanding work. She is a declared feminist, and she fought for the equality of women. And yet, they created a picture of her in the media here in Toronto and in New York, of course, that she was like Lady Macbeth. She had to be the person, right, who was pushing Bernard Cord to be do bad things. It's a terrible thing that we should fall that a
well those people
that story so easily.
Those people who make those claims, ask them what have they really contributed toward the movement. You know, the narrative of Phyllis Cord pushing Bernard is totally false. You know, been working with Bernard for years, and I could tell you he's not no pusher wrong. You know, he's a man of principle, right? Mm-hmm. And Phyllis is a strong woman, strong-willed woman too. She has her activities that she wanted to see for women. And so she take up the women. I mean, around the world, women are exploited, you know? more women are sold into a sex slave and all kinds of stuff over the world. Freeze was, if she was alive today, she was in, if the revolution was wrong today, she was one of the person to be in the forefront of fighting against trafficking, women trafficking, you know? So I could see her even in her death, you know, fighting for women's rights, mm-hmm. you know? So the power that be understood, that power that she had to command the women movement around the world. Understand that Grenada was able, and the Americans said, Grenada is more dangerous than Cuba and the Nicaraguan Nicaraguan Revolution, because Grenada speak English, right? The leadership of Grenada speak English, and they're 99% black. That make a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States.
Yes.
So you could understand if the women movement in the United States was influenced by Phyllis, what a problem America would have on their hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that make her very dangerous to them.
We're speaking to Jean Caliste. I almost turned you into French. Jean Caliste.
Yes.
And it's GemFM, by the way, .ca, GemFM, .ca. Can you, let me just say, I was working here in Toronto. I was a close associate of Charles Roach, an outstanding defense counsel here. He and I and others spoke up at the time of the crisis that you were experiencing in Grenada. And in our view, this was a matter of the New Jewel movement, the Grenadian people,
mm-hmm.
and it's terrible moments happen. But that was an issue for Grenadans and the New Jewel, all of whom were capable and mature enough to solve. But of course, Reagan and his friends chose to opportunistically crush back. And what is your take on, they were working or a problem, that problem would have been solved, would it not, had Reagan not smashed?
Well. Yes, following the death of Morris, I'm gonna back up a bit. I think with the fallout that was existing, the bickering within the movement at the central committee level, that was the straw that broke the camel back, the house arrest of Morris and so on. But with the total backdrop of what really happened, the end result, many people will say, well, the CIA was involved. Some people will say, no, the CIA wasn't involved. And there are a lot of people have different ideas of what happened, and nobody really, I mean, if you read my book, you will hear, get a real breakdown of what really happened in Grenada, and his book, The Grenada Revolution, what really happened. But I'm being there, and I'm gonna just say for what I saw leading up and what happened, what could have been done, what could have changed the whole course of things. I remember on the morning of the 19th, uh-huh. all right? We was at Fort Frederick the morning, and a young lady who was in the operating room, radio room, said, Callis, there's a phone call from Fort Rupert, and could you take it? This for one of you guys, the security detail guys. So I took the phone call, and it was from Corporal Peters, Dorset Peters, who I knew very well, because he's from my same village, just up the street from where I live. And while talking to him, I was saying, look, these guys are taking over the operating room and they're flying to hand out weapons to the masses. You guys got to take action, send somebody to put some order here. And the same time, Unison Whiteman came in. Because I knew their voice, I worked with UNI before, I knew the Bain, Fitzroy Bain voice, and I knew Vincent Noel's voice, because I have close association with those folks. And he said to me, that's who it is. I said, it's Comrade Callis on the phone here. He said, Comrade Callis, I want all of you to surrender to the nearest police station or face your guys' debt. No more compromise, no more negotiation. Surrender officer guys dead. That was the message. I immediately went to my supervisor, which was Roger Kess James at the time, and say, James, here's a message to pass on to the guys in the room, right? Which was Ewart Lane and so on. So after that, I think Ewart Lane came out and he got the same message. And whatever transpired from there, they sent soldiers to the fort to put order in the fort, and they was fired upon. So, and I have testimonies of soldiers who were on the fort who said, look, this is what happened. Even a friend who actually, through my radio station, he was talking to me. I said, look, I was there. I saw Vincent Noel's car had weapons in hand out to people. And he said, look, I'm out of here. This is going to turn ugly. You know, so he took off. I have another soldier friend when I was doing the show many years ago, about 3 years ago, he called me. He said, come, Murray Callies. I was there. I was 16 years old. Maurice was walking up to the gate and Kishu took my weapon from me in front of Maurice's presence. They disarmed me right there. You know, he still has his weapon number that they took from him. You know, so the whole notion that the soldiers went up there and just start firing and people like that. Yeah, nobody condoned what went on, and from both sides, it wasn't pleasant, right? But if they were open to negotiation and not planning to kill anybody, part of the thing would have turned off differently. Yeah. You know, who give orders? Nobody. I can't say I heard anybody give orders to anything. To who say kill who or whatever. That was never mentioned in any of the meetings or any situation where I was in. All right. So I can't say, well, this person gave. What I know, though, that the general Hudson Austin was not there. Uh-huh. He was not involved in any of those things until probably the next day, because during that same day when Lieutenant Colonel Ewart Lane said, look, the general cannot be found, so I'm taking over the operations today. I am now the commanding officer of the armed forces. So the Hudson Austin, who I always say to people, I'm not afraid to say it, he made an innocent jail.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, whatever happened, if the other side was willing, and Moise wasn't the one making that decision, it was Unison Whiteman, Fitzroy Bean, and Vincent Well, who came on the phone with the, and you actually, Unison spoke to me, Unison Whiteman spoke to me personally, and he told me that. You know? Comrade Kellis, all of what I need to surrender to the nearest police station, or face your guys dead. That was the threat. That was what they said. No more negotiation, no surrender on their part.
Yeah.
We surrender or face our dead.
Yeah,
that was what was said.
And also, we should all appreciate this. Such nations around the world have all experienced tragedies, political differences that become exaggerated or exploited by bad elements. And their lives have been lost in every country on the earth, politically.
Yes.
There was no justification, mm-hmm. except unless you have a colonial mindset that somehow this is becomes London and Washington's business to rob a country of its sovereignty because there's been a tragedy, political tragedy. And it led to a second one, which, of course, was the imprisonment. Well, first of all, the trial.
Right.
Which again, long imprisonment of 17 outstanding individuals.
And just to plug a pin in that there, hold it right, because with the trial, and, you know, one of the biggest, the conviction was mainly based on Cletus St. Paul's testimony, which, again, was a false testimony. And I think he should be held accountable for that, because them, right? He heard them, and he was, and that's a lie, because at the time of the killing on the foot, he was in my presence, right? Away from Bernard Code and everybody else. And I was not given an opportunity to testify in the court on those issues. Many of us who was there on the other foot with Bernard and so on, we were not given the opportunity to testify in the court against in their defense.
Did you say you were not allowed to participate?
No, we wasn't called to testify, and they knew who we were, because the reason why I knew who they knew who we was, and on the 26th, 27th of October, American soldiers and two Jamaican soldiers came to my house with helicopters above and came with a picture with Bernard and myself, asking me if I knew where Bernard was, you know? And I said, if you have my picture, then you should know where he is. Go find him, you know? And they took me away and kept me for what I think it was 2 days or something like that. Yeah, 2 days. Yeah. But the fact that it is that the trial itself was hinged, the conviction was based on Clitus St. Paul's testimony, which was Maurice Bishop's personal security as well. Mm-hmm. So he lied in that testimony. He was nowhere. As a matter of fact, when he brought secured Bernard and them, he was nowhere there. He wasn't close. However, when the shooting began on the fort, we were standing together at Fort Frederick. So he had no idea. As a matter of fact, he was handcuffed, sitting on a box of ammunition. And I could tell him that any day in his face, we were sitting there, we was questioning him, St. Paul, what went wrong? What happened to you? He said, Maurice, F up. That's what he said to us. F up, Maurice, F up, right? And if he knew, he wouldn't follow Maurice. Maurice lied to him, right? To spread the rumor. So when he go on the court and say that he heard them, he lied. He was sitting in a box of ammunition that day. And when the shooting started happening, we all walked towards the fence, the barrier, looking over to the fort down there, right? Mm. So he was never close to that decision or whoever made decision. Whatever happened in that room, he was never close to that. So that was another lie he made up. And that was what convicted those men. That was on which the sentence was based, because of his testimony.
But the court missed out on witnesses that could have clarified that. You weren't allowed. You were somehow not called. Is that right?
You're breaking up.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. And by the way, I'll just tell our listeners, this is the Taylor Report. We're speaking to John Calist, gemfm.ca, Genesis Magazine Radio, online family radio station. I just wanted to clarify. So there were people who could have, if the court had been properly run, whose evidence would have changed the picture entirely.
Yes, most definitely. As a matter of fact, even the very rumor that was circulating at the time, right? Mm-hmm. And people who was not there would give you a different story. One of the things that happened there was when the first rumor came out, it was Bernard Code and Phyllis Code wanted to kill Maurice. Then they changed around to Phyllis Code, put her first as the instigator, Phyllis Code and Bernard Code. You understand what's going on? So the psychology behind that, put her first, Phyllis Code and Bernard Code. Mm-hmm. Instead of putting Bernard and Phyllis. So they changed the story around, they twist it around to make it sound that, okay, Phyllis is the bad one here, not Bernard. She's really inciting.
Yeah, it was the Lady Macbeth, right?
Yes.
The evil woman. Mm-hmm. Who destroys an honest man to achieve something. It's just, you know, we're so much victimized by a kind of stereotypical thinking. And definitely that was a story that the media put out.
Yes.
I would say from day one, we began to hear these stories, which were totally misrepresenting who Phyllis Cord was, but of course, who also was Bernard Cord. By the way, Bernard Cord, something remarkable while in prison with ordinary prisoners there. Could you talk about that?
Well, actually, I heard about it. We used to raise funds and get barriers to send down for them in the prison for the work they was doing in the prison. A matter of a couple years ago, I was walking across Eglinton Avenue, and a friend that I knew very many years ago, his brother and I served in the army together. And he was hostile towards those men. But then his son was one of the beneficiaries of the teaching while he's in prison. And we was talking, and there was a change of attitude towards Bernard when I met him that other time. And he said, you know what? My son was educated by them. And his stories and what he told me about his people is not the same thing. So he had not met Bonnard, but his son was able to tell him from the prison, or he came from prison, what he, you know, the education that he got. You know, he was so impressed with his son's story about Bonnard. He recanted and repented of his attitude towards Bonnard,
yeah.
You know, and he wanted to thank them for it. But, you know, I'm hoping to get him on a show one of these days to talk about his experience and his son's experience in the prison one of these good days.
Yeah. By the way, that's the best kind of testimony, isn't it? Somebody who did not know or had not had any previous contact, and then they come on their own and say, this guy was
good. His son was educated in the prison by them. Yeah. So then his son was able to speak to that.
Yeah. Well, this has been very edifying. John, I think you ought to write a book personally. your testimony is very important. It's clear, isn't it, that the story actually has, the truth is catching up after all these years of misrepresentation of the events. Is it your impression that we're finally getting a clear picture of what occurred and also of the actual value of these individuals and the contribution they made?
Well, you know, everyone in the my battery is running low. I gotta get the charger onto this.
All right, go
the,
ahead.
The whole idea, let me just get my battery.
I like this. This is how creative we can be with devices.
Yes.
I'll remind everybody, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're talking to John Calist of gemfm.ca. And we're in a new setting.
Yes.
Yes, if you were that summary, we had two outstanding individuals, 17 were in prison. The new jewel accomplished a lot, but the truth is catching up, is it not? Yeah, the last question is, we are finally getting the truth and coming to understand and appreciate these people.
Right. A matter of fact, a lot of people, one of the stories that people never really heard probably in the public, and I would say one of my stories, and probably if I was given the opportunity to testify in that hearing, my realization of what I saw the breakdown happen. And I remember it was a Tuesday morning. I went home from my 4 days of working. I had a 2 days off, 2 days in reserve, and I took 2 days to go to my home. And when I got home, I decided to walk up the streets a little bit, just in the neighborhood, just walk, okay, you know, haven't been around for a while. Go up there around after 10 in the morning to see what's going on in the neighborhood. I was sitting in front of a store, a shop, which was belonging to Caldwell Taylor, who was the UN ambassador for Grenada, his mom's shop. I was sitting in front there. And whilst I was sitting there, I saw Bonnard's car going up the street, and there was no backup vehicle. And that to me was a some sign, something wasn't right. So I immediately got up because I had a sense of what was going on already. The deteriorating aspect of what's happening around the security forces and stuff like that. So I immediately went back home and packed my bag and said, I'm going back. I'm going down right away. My mom asked me, where are you going? I said, something not right. I'm going back. I can't be out here like this. I got to go down. Because Bonnard car, I just see Bonnard car go up with only one car, no backup. And then the driver that was supposed to be driving was not the driver. The security I saw in the back wasn't the person to be walking. So I immediately packed my bag and I head back to Bonnard's house. And I got there, I started asking questions. And then I went down to the Ministry of Mobilization and I asked, because some of my other comrades was down there. So I went there and I asked, what's going on? He said, I don't know. Something's up. We don't know what happened. And around midnight that night, I remember I was downstairs Bonnard's house, and the duty officer came up and he was searching. And I wasn't supposed to be in the camp that night. I was off. I had my pass. And then he said, but your name is not on the list to be here. You should be on pass. I said, no, I came back in this afternoon. So I'm here. So you can register me as being in, because they're signing as coming in, right? Because I came from the other side and just go up to Bonner's house with one large compound. So I got there and quickly they had a meeting in the soldiers, the special unit. We had a special unit barracks where the special unit that surrounded the leadership was staying, and went down the mess hall, and the commander at the time, Ashley Ram Fuchs, said there's a new development and we need to brief you guys on what's going on. And we have a situation here with a letter from Errol George, who states that there's a rumor that he was forced to spread that given to him by Morris and Cletus St. Paul, because Cletus St. Paul was the head and Errol George was the assistant commander of the security in Morris's house. The security detail from Morris. And he said that they told him that he had to go and spread a rumor, say that Phyllis Code and Bonner Code want to kill Morris. Uh-huh. And he said, what? So he said, if he doesn't go, he's going to have an accident, which uh-huh. means accident means that he will die right in his house. Yeah. And he went. So he had specific instructions of who to go to start spreading the rumor.
Wow. Right?
Yeah. So that aspect of this story that a lot of people in the masses didn't get.
Yeah.
Right. So I know there is people who could testify to that, what was said to us by Ashley Ram Fuchs. He was the commander. And then Errol George had to go in hiding, obviously, because he did not want to continue to spread the rumor as directed by Morris and Cletus St. Paul.
Yeah.
So that was when everything really changed. The atmosphere had changed from that time on.
Yeah.
So that's where it was. So, and then everything started. Then the Wednesday after that, I think, I can't remember Wednesday, Fitzroy being, as a matter of fact, one lady came to see Morris, that Morris was under house arrest, and she was told that she couldn't see Morris. She agreed, she dropped the fruit, and she went back. Vincent Noel came up, I think, later on in the day, and he was escorted over to the central, the main area, where the common area between Morris and Bonner's house. And he was questioned, and they went to search his house and found that they had more weapons than he was allotted to in his house, right? So he again was dealt with accordingly. And then Fitzroy Bain came up the next week, I think it was the Wednesday, and he said, you want to see Morris? And he said, no, tell me, can't see. And he started cussing up, using the F word and saying, oh, we go, blood go run like water, we go arm the masses tomorrow, and so on and so on. They immediately arrested him. That's uh-huh. when he got arrested, right? Fitzroy being arrested. But before that, Jacqueline Clef came and she wanted to see Morris. And I think one of his soldiers said to her, that if you go and you will not be able to come back out, you got to stay with the chief. And yeah. she agreed to stay with the chief.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of the details that people don't get out there that should have been given, but the narrative was never to give those kind of stories and to tell that kind of a truth. They want to have it one way, that Phyllis Code and Bonner Code wanted to kill Morris.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was permitted to be personalized and demonized.
Yes, exactly. That's the whole thing.
Unfortunately, it was also a factor that they began to tell stories or use the fact that Phyllis was from Jamaica and this
trusted. Yes. But she was a nice woman. I mean,
people want to make trouble. They know how to do it.
Exactly. If you want, I mean, Phyllis Code was, I mean, a very nice mother. I mean, even to us, who was the personal security, she was very nice to us. She greeted us with respect and, you know, treated us right. I mean, like, I can see a day I remember Phyllis getting up to any of the security details around her. There was not a day. I mean, like, we pick her up and to meet Bonner on the beach after I had this work. They meet and they take turns to go to visit different projects after work together. They go to the international airport, they go to the Mount Hartman farm, they check out the feeder road programs, they keep checking everything. I remember Bonner just go up and say, okay, we're taking a drive, we're gone, let's take a drive through the country and see what's going on. Every project, nighttime, you know, they will get up and go and check projects and stuff like that, you know. So I mean, Bonner was the only person I could recall that committed what we call committed class suicide.
Uh-huh.
You know, he gave up everything to the state. He had nothing. you know, after the ocean collapse, he had nothing. You know, he had no money, he had nothing, you know. So again, people saying that, oh, they had plenty of money on them and stuff like that. That was a lie. It's totally a lie. Bernard had no money. You know, I was born the night of the invasion when the first bomb dropped, you know, it was all together.
I think I lost your audio there for a moment. John Callist, I want to thank you very much. It's gemfm.ca, and you've really inspired me to get my hands on Unchained by Phyllis Cord. I love the portrait that you have painted of her, a great woman. And if we can, I'd like to bring you back and we'll just talk about her book.
And next time.
She needs to be appreciated. Bernard Cord needs to be, and all the people who made the New Jewel movement.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who contributed. I mean, the 17, many of them, again, have made significant contribution towards the Green Revolution, you know.
And they're still making contributions.
Still making contributions, you know. You know, all of us. I mean, like, what I'm doing today, you know, is part revolutionary, part academic, what I learned in school. But I must also say that being around Bernard and seeing his work ethics and how he dealt with his family had caused me to be who I am today, you know, taking initiative and doing things, you know, being the person that is always challenging the norm and doing things and getting things done. You know, I came here and all of my strength, my latter years, I mean, I was turning 16 when I joined the army to work as a personal security bonnet. I was 16.
So, and you've been soldiering for a long time.
Yes, you know, and I still, like I said to people, I mean, because I told Bonnet, I went to the prison, I said to him, Bonnet, look, I didn't really like you. I didn't like you at all. As a matter of fact, I shared a story with him, and I will share it with you. It was a Bloody Sunday rally in Simon. I was just probably 14 years old, and he was about to speak, and I was standing in a group of some soldiers, like and some union bosses at the time, Lucius, Hostick, OC name right now, but Lashington and Captain Gill, there was officers, high office ranking officers in the army. And I said, look, I don't want to hear this man speak at all. And I told him why, because I heard the rumor that, you know, he just showed up in Grenada, you know, and he just wanted to run the whole thing. He and his wife wanted to take over the leadership of Grenada and stuff like that. So being pro Morris at the time and the New Jewel movement, understanding that my cousin, Jeremiah Richardson, was killed by police. That was part of one of the biggest movement of change. That's when the biggest movement of change for the NJM began, with the Jeremiah Richardson shot, getting shot. And then my classmate and my friend, Harry Andrew, who we was playing a game of draft one night, and he left to go and watch a show, a Calypso show, and he was shot within 20 minutes of leaving me, you know?
Yeah.
And again, so I had this long love for the New Jewel movement, and there was not much talk about Bernard yet. So that negativity about Bernard was always being preached among the people. But when I got to work with Bernard, I was kind of skeptical. When I see the work ethics, the commitment, you know, on both people's part, I mean, they were working hard. You know, Bernard will have, I tell you something, Bernard wasn't a rich person.
That's very important testimony. I mean, people have to understand who these, when you say that people are dedicated and they're working hard, those are important,
very hard
important aspects of them. Most of the bad guys don't work that hard.
No. Well, man, I could tell you, I mean, I see other ministers do stupidness. I mean, I'm working with them. I mean, I work with George Reason, who to me, in my opinion, I always see he was a mole. And people, a lot of people might say, well, why do you say that? I believe he was a mole in the NJM. I think he was planted back in 1969, way back then when he was with the CIA. I always believe that. And I never changed my narrative, changed my belief on that. I believe he was the mole in the whole thing. Because he was the one. Went back to convince Morris to change his mind about joint leadership position. So again, I always believe that he was the one who was the most destructive among everyone. He was the most ill-disciplined in my view, you know, and you know, he loved the bottle, you know. Yeah. So again, I mean,
the things you've been touching on, all these things have got to be revisited.
Yeah.
And thank heavens we have someone like yourself who lived through it, and a wonderful source. I think we have to leave it there, but
yes, no problem.
Thank you very, very much. And most we're going to come back and speak at a future date about Phyllis Court and the books of both by Phyllis and Bernard Court. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. You're most welcome, sir.